This is Democracy,
a podcast that explores the interracial, intergenerational, and intersectional
unheard voices living in the world's
most influential democracy.
Welcome to This is Democracy. Our episode today will focus on Congress, one of the most discussed institutions in our society today with our midterm election, and an institution that is obviously vital to our democracy and an institution going through major changes. We have with us my colleague and friend, Ruth Wassum. Ruth is one of the foremost experts on Congress in the United States today, in addition to being a great bubbly person and a wonderful teacher. Ruth spent about 25 years at the Congressional Research Service, and she has taught in many places. Now we're fortunate to have her teaching here at the LBJ School at UT. Welcome, Ruth.
It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
It's nice to have you on. Before we talk to Ruth, we have Zachary's poem. What's your poem title today, Zachary?
One Man.
One Man. Okay, well, let's hear it.
My house, where I left so many times, only to come home again. My house, where I stacked my books to the height of the ceiling. My house, where I cried into my pillow of the Saturday slaughter at the synagogue. My house, where I howled with the stereo songs about sandwiches. Does my house have nobody? My school, where I smiled, having found the answer. My school, where I screamed, banged my head against the bathroom stall. My school, where I whimpered beneath the desk as the lights went dark, drilling it into me. My school, where I yelled across the deck about the state of the Ukraine, does my school have nobody? My city, where I read from the unfurled scroll the day I became a man. My city, where I rolled in the grass under the blue skies. My city, where I roamed the library in awe of all the words written. Where I stood for hours among the vinyl stacks. My city, torn by the river into two, strewn across the sidewalk by the bombs that came in the mail, brought to its knees by having too much water. Does Austin only have one man? Does the high ceiling not cut through the moonlit sky? Do I not sleep facing north along the western wall's sunburnt figure? Is the taste of a thousand spills a layer of dust on the couch, not the eternal underpinning of these wood floors? Does the sound of canvas against aluminum not mark those wind-filled lunch hours on the deck? Do I not know the feel of the old handrail under forceful palms launching one into the air? Is the purple rain serenade every 12:06 p.m. not the soul of my school? Does the ground I walk upon not scream against every indifferent footstep? Do I not hear the whisper of the forgotten in every whine of the interstate? Is the voice of Willie Nelson from the record player not the scripture of the asphalt city I tread? Do I not know my city? Do I live somewhere, someone else?
A lot of interesting references there, Zachary. What's the relationship between your poem and Congress?
Well, my poem talks about how unique, like, the places I see every day are in my city and my school and my house. And it asks the question, do we have nobody to represent this? And I don't see that it's represented in Congress or in other legislative bodies.
The unique features of our city, you don't see them represented.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think, the best spot to turn to Ruth. Ruth, why do so many Americans feel that Congress doesn't represent them?
Well, let's begin with the poem, because it's set in Austin, Texas. And Austin, Texas is a classic example of a community that has a definite identity, and in fact, many communities within it that have identity, and yet it has been hacksawed into a variety of different congressional districts so that the people of Austin do not have a voice in any congressional district. So it's a very real thing that you're experiencing, Zachary, and it has to do with how our congressional districts are currently apportioned. And it raises important issues about representational government and small-r Republican forms of government.
Right.
When we have congressional districts that are carved up in such a way and generally, they were carved up to maximize incumbency. Now, when some states, when they were controlled by a particular party, some of the one of the parties was much wiser, cleverer, smarter, whatever you want to say, in carving up their jurisdictions so that their candidates or candidates representing their political philosophy would be more likely to be represented.
Is this a new phenomenon?
Well, gerrymandering was named after Eldridge Gerry from New York State, wasn't it?
I think he's from Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, from, you know, the early federal period. So it's not new. But we've gotten so intelligent in our use of data and our the ability to analyze, you know, using computers and all sorts of different things very quickly and efficiently, that it's not like back in the day where somebody had stacks of paper and election returns and they were trying to draw a map, you know, in pencil. Now you can just do it in an instant, and you can come up with algorithms to draw the districts.
And so, why does Congress do this? I mean, people are taught in schools that Congress is a legislative policymaking body that's designed to represent the people. Why is there such an emphasis on this? And has that emphasis grown in the last 20 to 30 years? Is it just the new technology, or is it actually a greater emphasis upon being reelected at all costs?
Well, it is interesting, and I don't know the answer to that on the whys. I'm sure different people had different motivations. I know in some states there was a desire by both parties to preserve incumbents. Right. They got together, and it didn't benefit Democrats or Republicans. It benefited incumbency.
A kind of collusion.
Well, I would not have used that word, but yes, I suppose it's apt. And so there is that bias towards incumbency, and we see it regardless of whether the districts are stacked. Incumbency has always been a benefit, something that helps someone get elected, and that's because they have name recognition. They've developed relationships with their constituents. They have powerful friends in lobbying interests. There's a whole host of ways those things work. But how does this play out in terms of the deliberative process of Congress, and has it changed the way things function? And I think that you can see in places, you know, if you look at the difference between districts that are highly competitive, and they're fewer and fewer now, those individuals who arguably, if you're, and you can look at election returns over time, and we've done that and studied it, looking at districts that are highly competitive, their members are not any less partisan than the ones that aren't.
Interesting.
Because when you're guaranteed re-election, if the district has been cut to serve you, you can do pretty well what you want to do. Mm-hmm. So there's an incredible amount of power on the individual member. So I was surprised to see how, at least in the historic analysis, in the data over time that I looked at competitive seats, that I realized, well, maybe the people in the competitive seats needed their party more.
Right.
And they ran in a way that reflected, you know, in order to show the distinction between their opponent.
Although it would seem this year that many, and thankfully there are more competitive districts this year than there were in the last election cycle, at least, it would seem that people running in competitive districts now do have to appeal to a lot of voters who are neither extreme Republicans or extreme Democrats.
Because of the rise in the people that proclaim they're independent.
Right.
They're pulling away from party IDs, and it's been an interesting phenomena because there was a time not too many years ago that people who identified as independents leaned conservative. Now it appears that people who identify as independents are more likely to lean progressive.
Right.
And that makes a difference. But at the end of the day, turnout is still quite important.
Yes.
And knowing for members, Let's get back to you preface this question with there are more competitive seats. And one of the reasons is we have a lot of retirees.
Right.
A lot of people in Congress are opting out, and unprecedented probably. Well, I want to say unprecedented because I haven't checked
over the last two.
Yes, in modern times, it's highly unusual to have this many number of people
retiring. I think
more than retirees.
30 Republican incumbents are retiring, running for re-election.
And so that creates potential for new people to enter the scene, even within their own party, new voices.
Right.
And it's made it a lot more exciting. The interesting thing for us to see in 2 weeks, we'll probably not know even the next day on some of these races how they came out because they're going to be close. But did turnout increase? And that's something, you know, we can look at.
Right.
That's something we can see. Did these competitive seats gin up interest among voters?
Right.
And that'll be very easy to measure.
Yes.
And this is where it gets even more interesting to me. What will that do for the political legislative process?
Right. And let's talk about that for a second. Before we talk about where we're going with the legislative process, where I know you have a lot of insights, let's just step back. For the last 20 to 30 years, as someone who follows the day-to-day in Congress, I think more closely than anyone else I know, Ruth, how has that changed? How have the committee structures changed? Why does Congress look the way it does today in its operations?
Well, beyond what we just talked about the apportionment, there was a lot of changes that occurred 20 years ago in the 90s. Newt Gingrich did a major reorganization.
Speaker of the House.
Yes. He was the minority leader of the Republicans. And when they were in the minority, he was quite the bomb thrower and colorful figure and set up a contract with America that they ran on in 1994 and won. And suddenly a party that had not been in power in a long time was thrust in power. They changed their whole style away from the style of Bob Mitchell of Illinois, who was a Midwestern Republican and always interested in governing and being a player and worked with the Democrats because he wanted to have influence and an impact, to someone who had not worked with the Democrats, who'd offered a very clear distinction. Gingrich reorganized everything. And one of the things he did was he learned an important lesson from the failure of health care and the Clintons in the previous Congress, in that the committee chairs were too powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So he reorganized in such a way that the committee chairs rotated. They didn't become, they couldn't become these fiefdoms in the same way that they had for so many years. And to be a committee chair, you had more of a direct relationship with the speaker.
So that increased the power of the speaker.
It definitely increased the power of the speaker. And then going forward, you really saw Speaker Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, when she was speaker, also drawing on that to be a powerful speaker who had people in the committee positions who were going to carry out the priorities of the party.
I see.
So the independence of the committee chairs was a big change. Another really important change that's happened over the last 20 years, and I can't overestimate enough how technology and the way constituents can communicate to their members.
Yes.
I remember, you know, with emails, I remember someone, when I first started working, they complained about the faxes coming in. That's FAX, by the way.
I think a lot of our listeners don't even know what a fax machine is.
Look it up. You can Google it. But before, when people had to sit down, write a letter, put a stamp on it, the whole way the public communicated, the constituents changed. That meant congressional offices had to change.
Yes.
And they shifted away. Members used to hire, if there were policy areas that they wanted to be, they were particularly concerned with, they'd hire someone on their staff who had expertise in that. So not just committee staffs who we are supposed to have be staffed by experts in that topic that the committee has jurisdiction over, but individual members often populated their offices with people who had policy expertise. Well, once you started being inundated with constituent stuff and having your ability to stay at office hinge on your relationship with constituents, members shifted their staff around, put a lot more people in casework, and case workloads hit the roof. I mean, the amount of work that came in through casework, they had to. So they shifted away from kind of seasoned policy staff to people that were just cranking out responses to a flood of constituent inquiries. And it changed the nature of a congressional office. They had to set up management systems. The kind of person that the title they used to call the AA, the administrative assistant, which was really more of a senior policy person. Right. That job, you know, suddenly it was more of an office manager.
Right. Right.
And they said, and some offices called them office managers because the whole workload and nature of a congressional office shifted.
What about the relationship among members of Congress? It's often said, Ruth, that it used to be in Lyndon Johnson's time, for example, right, that members of Congress spent a lot of time together, you know, having brunch at Lady Bird's table on Sunday morning and things of that sort. Has that changed?
Dramatically. And I'll use the example of Dan Lundgren, who is a congressman from California.
Okay.
He had been a Reagan Republican, elected to Congress as a young man in the 80s, and was considered, you know, a Reagan Republican, conservative
sure.
for his time. And he lived in a group house with another Republican member and two Democratic members.
Wow.
And that was not uncommon.
Uh-huh.
People, members, you know, their families usually stayed back in the districts. And so they would have just rent a room in a
sure.
house. And it was not uncommon to see socializing across party lines. So Lundgren, he had been in the 90s, I believe it was in the 90s, he left to run for office in California. He
gotcha.
Was Attorney General of California. He was there for a while. Well, in the 2000s, he came back. He ran again for Congress, and he served a couple terms. And I remember him commenting on how different it was.
Right, right.
How the civility...
Right.
The kind of just informal relationships and friendships and the time spent together that the milieu had totally changed.
Yeah. And why?
And,
why did that happen?
Well, a couple things. One was that they moved the work week around.
Okay.
And they wanted a family-friendly work week so that members could go home. So they started the work week on Tuesdays through Thursdays. All the votes would happen Tuesdays through Thursdays. And that's what all the committee business
right.
would occur.
So they had more time to raise money.
So they would go back home to be with their family, Jeremy. They're family friendly. And it was, and so when members are there, they really work hard.
Sure, of course. They, that's
you
a
know,
tough
it's,
job,
yeah. it, I mean, all day long, breakfast meetings all day. The Rules Committee always met at night, almost always. And it was very hard. Well, they didn't socialize with each other anymore.
Right, right.
So a lot of the places and other, you still see, and one of the reasons the Senate was seen as staying more congenial was senators usually move their families because they're
right.
on six-year terms. So you'd see a lot more bipartisan friendships,
right.
relationships across families and stuff with the senators because
right.
they were there all the time and develop these relationships in a way that the House members came, or some of them even sleep in their offices.
Yep. Yeah, Senator Ben Sasse does that, I believe.
Does he do that too?
Yeah,
interesting. Our former LBJ colleague.
Yeah.
So that you don't have the same collegiality that you
right.
used to have. Politics has also gotten ugly.
Sure.
I'm not going to say that there hasn't been a change in what's people keep pushing the envelope
right.
in saying things and getting away with it.
Yeah.
Whereas before you would have been sanctioned
right.
On the floor.
Sure.
For
censure was
things.
A big deal before. Right?
It was a very big deal. And so those, now we all know that there was a time when someone took his cane and caned another
sure.
person
sure.
150 years ago
sure.
or longer
ago. On the eve
ago.
Of the Civil War. Yeah.
But,
the caning
but
of
that
Charles
was,
Sumner.
That was rare. And we that's why we still remember it.
Right.
We haven't gotten to caning yet. Thank God. I must confess, I grew more and more concerned with the demeanor,
yes,
and the way members treated each other. It's a concern of mine that civility. Because you're doing the people's business.
Right. I think it's a concern of many voters. And I think especially among younger citizens who want a Congress, as Zachary was referring to, that's more representative, that actually deals with important legislative issues like health care and gun control and things of that sort. This is no longer acceptable. So maybe we can spend our last 5 or 6 minutes drawing on your knowledge and your thoughts, Ruth, on where you see this going. I mean, what kinds of changes can we expect if, as is likely, because of retirements and because of the more competitive districts, if we have a whole new class, maybe like in the early 1970s, a whole new class
of members. Like the Watergate class.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, a whole new class. And the Watergate class certainly changed Congress with oversight over the intelligence agencies and things
and,
of that sort.
And with the committee structure.
Correct.
Yes.
So what can we expect from that historical precedent of the 1970s for 2019 and 20 after this election?
A lot of it will hinge on how they conduct themselves when they come in.
The new members.
The new members. If they come in highly charged and still in campaign battle mode, if they don't shift gears into the deliberative process, then we'll have more of the same. If once they're in Congress, they say, okay, I got elected to get things done, and they realize that in order to get things done, I've got to find enough votes. And it's how do we learn how to build coalitions and get and craft our policy proposals to get votes among our colleagues. So it's that blending of what is good public policy? What is the best course of action on a particular policy problem? And then in the course I teach on legislative development, my students have to have 3 options to address the problem. By now, they've already done their 3 options. Then they do, okay, how do I get there? What's the strategy?
Right.
And many times, after you might have one that you think's the best, but you have 2 more that are doable that you're perfectly fine with, and that's where you build your compromises and coalitions.
Right.
So that you might realize that, what's the classic, the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Correct.
That if you just always hold out for the perfect, nothing happens. And and you get bitter.
Right.
So, but if you can get things done, so I always am hopeful.
Good, me too.
So I'm always an optimist, and I'm willing to say that this new crop, because they're all new, a lot of them will be.
Of course.
That they will be more, they'll have things they want to see happen. They're going to try to get things done. It will be difficult in an environment where there's such a divide.
Right.
But
do you think there'll be a big difference, Ruth, with so many more women in Congress? I mean, there are more women running now than ever before.
Yes.
On both sides of the aisle, particularly on the Democratic side, but also on the Republican side. And if you look at the numbers, it's quite likely we'll have far more women in Congress, especially in the House.
Yes.
Do you think that'll make a difference?
I think, I'd like to think it would as a woman, that women are bring a different kind of temperament. And maybe just more willing to try to get things done, to finish things. Certainly the demeanor usually of women is less pugnacious.
Right.
At least in public,
right.
I am not
right.
going to say. So I think it'll make a difference. I think, and we know Congress is growing more and more diverse.
Right.
The last Congress was the most diverse
Correct.
We've had. We're starting to have more religions reflected.
Right.
The extent to which, and we're going to have more women in leadership roles because
right.
we've got a group of women that have been around a while that are moving up in the leadership ranks.
Right.
And yes, I think the presence of women would make a difference, will make a difference.
Mm.
But would it... I wouldn't look to it as the sole factor.
Absolutely. No, yeah, it's one of many factors, as you've pointed out so well. So maybe the last question I can ask you now, and we can, of course, continue this discussion after the election when we have more details. But when the new Speaker of the House calls you, whoever that Speaker is, and asks you, you know, what should be my top priority in terms of structural reform? What's the one thing you'd like to see Congress do to make itself more effective going forward and to make itself more representative, or at least to make people feel they're more represented in Congress?
I think getting rid of the Hastert rule.
Okay, explain.
And that was something that the Republicans put in place, that they would not bring a bill to the floor if it didn't have a majority of support in their own caucus. So a majority of Republicans had to support something before any bill could come to the floor.
This is why gun control has never come to the floor, right?
And a lot of things have never. And it was kind of what did in Speaker John Boehner.
Right.
Because sometimes to govern, particularly on appropriations and budgets and military and foreign affairs things, you govern from the middle.
Right.
And the Hastert rule prevented governing from the middle once the Freedom Caucus was large enough, and that's a conservative group of Congress, kind of morphed out of the Tea Party that won earlier, that they effectively had a veto over anything that could come to the floor. So Congress did not represent, in its own functionings, the majority of its own members, because there were many times when moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats agreed on something that the conservative Republicans and the liberal Democrats wouldn't have, but we could have gotten a lot of things done without that. And it would have represented the majority.
It's such a good insight, because one would assume that a majoritarian institution would bring things to a vote where you might have 40% of the minority and 60% of the majority agreeing with it and have enough to pass. But under this procedure, which is a new procedure, right, going back a little less than two decades now, something can't come to the floor unless the majority party itself has a majority that supports.
So you're letting a minority rule.
Correct. And it makes things much more partisan. It's all about whether the majority party agrees as a whole, rather than building a coalition.
And it means there's no need to reach across the aisle.
Right.
Whereas before, that was part of doing it, and you would often see that play out in committee process.
It penalizes reaching across the aisle, as Speaker Boehner did.
So found out, yeah.
So that's a case where clearly a new crop of members of Congress could change things very quickly. Most people don't realize the rules Congress operates or the rules Congress makes.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of every Congress.
So Zachary, to close us out today, what do you think of this? I mean, as we get into this wonderful discussion with Ruth about the complexities of Congress and the complexities of elections, this departs a lot from the way people are taught in civics about Congress. How do young people think about this, and how can we get them more engaged with these issues?
Well, I think that young people like myself are not willing to compromise as much on certain beliefs, but I do think that they do expect their representatives to work across the aisle, and I don't think that they're wary of stagnation when nothing happens. And I do think that and they do believe, and they, even though they don't always see it happening, and know it's not always happening, in the sort of civics textbook view of everything works, and you can get a majority of moderates to make legislation.
So do you think your colleagues and friends, do you think you would be more willing than others to vote for people who are compromisers and willing to do this kind of work that Ruth has described?
Well, I think yes, but in certain situations, I don't think that that's like the main issue of many voters, younger voters. I think they want to have someone who agrees with them, but they don't want to have someone who's just going to filibuster for their entire 6 years or two years.
Right. Well, I think these comments from Ruth and Zachary make it clear that one of the challenges we all face as citizens is finding people whose values and policy preferences we endorse, but people who are also willing by temperament and by skill set to work with those who differ. And Congress doesn't function when it's all about ideological rigidity, as it's become. And Ruth has explained why this has become a structural problem. The structures will be changed when we have people in place, trained by Ruth and others, who know how to actually work across the aisle while still remaining true to their values. I, for one, am faithful that that's exactly where young voters are. I think young voters are problem solvers, and they have strong values, but they also want to get things done. So please go out and vote, and please help us get things done. And thank you for joining us in our discussion of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harrison Lemke, and you can find his music at harrisonlemke.com.
Subscribe and stay tuned for a new episode every Thursday featuring new perspectives on democracy.